Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and this is the sound of competing rallies in downtown Boston over the weekend.
No violence. No violence, no matter what flag you have.
With images of the violence in Charlottesville fresh in their minds, Boston law enforcement exercised tight control on demonstrators Saturday as white nationalists and counter-protesters gathered on the city's commons. There were anti-nationalist demonstrations in places like Dallas and Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Portland, Oregon. Today, we're going to ask what concerned citizens who renounce the rise of these nationalist groups can do beyond marching. How do we be more than just bystanders? What should we do in our everyday encounters and routines to show that communities simply won't tolerate this? And as our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you as you contemplate how to be more than a bystander. Are you wrestling with this? Have you thought of some new ways to counter these hate groups? And are you searching for ways to be part of the pushback? And I'm not undermining the marches and the counter protests. They're important. But I think engaged citizens everywhere are thinking about, what can I do? What's meaningful? So as you think about that and you join the conversation, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Amy Allison is with us. She's president of Democracy in Color and host of a podcast by the same name. And Amy, it's really good to talk to you. I think the last time was during Indivisible. So welcome.
Oh, that's
welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Amos Giora is with us. He's a professor of law at the University of Utah and the author of a new book, The Crime of Complicity. And he is joining us this morning from Tel Aviv, Israel. And Amos, welcome. It's good to have you back on the show.
Carrie, it's always a pleasure.
Amy, here's what I fear about these counter demonstrations against the white nationalist groups. And I was just talking about this with a journalist friend this morning. The protests and the counter protests create conflict that draws the media, which draws attention, which gives these hate groups just what they want, more attention. How should we think about this? And how should we think beyond the rallies and the counter rallies?
Well, it's such a good question, because here I am in the Bay Area. The white nationalists are planning a march in San Francisco in just about a week. So cities all over the country are facing this same challenge. And I think part of it is figuring out what's going to work. When we looked at Boston, having upwards of 40,000 people show up and essentially take the space and overwhelm the square with positive messages of inclusiveness and anti-racism, that's one strategy. I know people in San Francisco were studying that. So just overwhelming, nonviolent numbers. That's one way. I want to say, though, just as a level set, that a lot of people aren't talking about taking or marching against white supremacy or the language of white supremacy or against Nazis. They're talking about marching against hate. And of course, it's always good to think about less hate. But the thing is, it's not really about hate that causes institutions that support white supremacy. It wasn't hate necessarily that built those monuments or caused the institution of slavery. You can hate someone all day and not murder or harm them, and you can not hate somebody, and yet people could feel warmly. So really, we need to take the idea about where the focus is on the protest out of just strong emotions of hate or even love into more examining the institutions that uphold systems that are abhorrent. And I think broadly, that's where people who are opposed to white supremacy and racism and Nazism and all the things that we see that are coming up need to put their energy. And it's not just one day. It's a long-term commitment to really fundamentally resetting what's happening in our country.
Amos, you've been in Israel for most of the summer. And I just wonder, as you've interacted with your friends and your colleagues and your fellow countrymen and women, what they think of these demonstrations by these neo-Nazis, especially given what you've been writing about.
So it's a great question that carries, you know, I have no hair but two hats. When Israelis view the demonstrations, particularly in Charlottesville, and the torch lights and the whatever they were yelling about Jews, for people, for instance, like my mother, who's a Holocaust survivor, which was one of the impetuses for writing the book, The Crime of Complicity, it is absolutely astonishing to her, A, that there are people marching through Charlottesville yelling whatever they were yelling about Jews. That's A. B, the president's press conference, if that's the correct term, last Tuesday, is jaw-dropping a good term? Let's go with that. But here in Israel, there's an additional piece to the puzzle, and that, I don't know if you want to get into it, but it's been the silence of Prime Minister Netanyahu in the face of clear anti-Semitism. One would have expected that he would have been the first to condemn the marchers of last Saturday, that he would have been critical of the president's very disturbing response on Tuesday. And so for Israelis, there's, I mean, enormous discomfort with what happened in Charlottesville, the anti-Semitism, the Nazism that is out there, but also part and parcel with here in Israel, with Prime Minister Netanyahu's acquiescence in the face of President Trump's, for me, deeply disturbing comments on Tuesday. So it's a twofold response with respect to Israel.
And just for just a moment on that, is that because Netanyahu is putting his relationship in geopolitics above what ought to be an obvious stand for integrity and denouncing this?
So twofold response. One, if this would have happened a year ago and if it would have been President Obama who would have responded the way President Trump did, I have no doubt that Netanyahu would have, pardon the expression, been all over him. Netanyahu seems to have a complicated relationship or a better relationship with Trump, whatever that means. But it complicates it because this is, if you want to get into this, President Trump has support amongst conservative Republican Jews and also amongst evangelicals. Your previous guest mentioned Falwell's son's very awkward response yesterday.
Right.
Important to remember that Netanyahu benefits from the support of Christian evangelicals who are aligned with Trump. But I don't think there's any doubt that Netanyahu's response is a very cold Machiavellian analysis in which he puts aside what is a no-brainer that any Israeli prime minister, as any American president, should condemn the speech that we heard Saturday night. There's a difference, though, whether that speech is illegal or is condemnable. Two different things.
Right.
You know, well, First Amendment scholars will give you two different takes on that. It should clearly have been condemned.
Okay. I don't want to get too much into Israeli politics because our focus is elsewhere.
Absolutely.
You know that. Okay. To the phones here to hear what some of our listeners are saying as I ask about how you wrestle with ways to be engaged with this, and not to undermine the value of the counter-protests. They're incredibly valuable. We saw that in Boston and in other cities. But what else in your day-to-day life? To the phones to Sheila in St. Cloud. Hi, Sheila. How have you been thinking about this?
Well, I think about this a lot. Community change is very important. And as a social work professor, it's central to the work that I do. But Dr. Jack Rothman teaches us that there are three ways to do this. One is locality development, building from the ground up, being part of local organizations that have an anti-oppressive lens and focus. That's one way. Another way is social policy, engaging in government, letters, lobbying, being concerned citizens that really engage with their legislators. And the third is, of course, social protest. But, you know, what you just mentioned, Carrie, is really, really important, which is that I sat with my mother and her friends last weekend and asked them, when was the moment that you knew that the civil rights movement was significant? And it was the moment they saw Sheriff O'Connor turning fire hoses on people in Alabama. And we can't forget that. We can't forget the importance of social protests. And what we find as inconvenient about Black Lives Matter today, what will future generations think about those efforts?
Wow. Sheila, I'm really glad you called, because earlier, Amy, you were talking about institutions, but I know you also very much know the value of what Sheila is saying about being out there and showing up and counter-protesting.
Yeah. It's interesting to that you brought up the civil rights movement, because if you follow like Dr. William Barber, who's written a really amazing book called Third Reconstruction, he says there's been efforts in our country to have a fully inclusive multiracial democracy, and that those efforts, the first one after the Civil War, the second one in civil rights, and we're in the middle, he argues, of a third Reconstruction where there's a move toward making our institutions, everything we can think of, all the businesses and the educational institutions and politics, reflect this multiracial inclusive democracy. And we're experiencing pushback from that. And that after the civil rights movement, we saw lots of efforts to try to right the wrongs that were baked into and actually supported white supremacy in terms of the institutions in our country, things like affirmative action. And we know that affirmative action was trying to give a leg up to people who had been excluded or kept down, and then there was pushback. Well, we're experiencing the same thing now. So I think part of it is that the value of protests is to not normalize the actions, or all these people saying that HBO has no business with going forward with the series on if the Confederacy had won, and going into the characters and having us feel for the characters, all that can normalize in a society people who hold these racist views. And so I think that protest really holds up, pushes back, but also needs to hold up an alternative vision of what we want in our society. And I think that alternative vision actually needs to be we need to focus on where in our society can we right the wrongs and actually change the institutions as the longer term strategy.
Call here from Chuck in St. Cloud. And by the way, if you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, call us back, because we have a lot of people getting in on the discussion. Hey, Chuck, hi. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I agree with your previous caller and everything that has been said about the importance of protesting, getting out and doing that. And I've had experience doing that, not much, but I think what people who can't do, people who can't get out and protest and join the big things, and especially for white males, I think it's more important to engage on an everyday level, to really look at what we do every day in our language, in our interactions, and how we relate to people, what values do we support.
So, Chuck, when you say holding other people accountable, what does that mean? I mean, you mean in everyday discussions where someone might say something that's not informed, or?
Well, I'm talking about accountable for our own actions.
Okay.
But what you say is, in spaces where I feel like I have a say, if you are a passenger in my car, mm-hmm. if you are a guest in my house, those are places where I have a certain amount of, I guess you could say, moral authority to say, well, this is my place and not here.
Good to have your call. I appreciate it, Chuck. Amos, I was reading historian Mark Bray's piece in the Washington Post over the weekend about white supremacy, and I think this is apropos to what our focus is and what you've been thinking about. He says, responding to small fascist groups may seem trivial to some, but the rise of Hitler and Mussolini show that resistance is not a light switch that can simply be flipped on in a crisis. So given what you're talking about in your book, how do you hear that?
I couldn't agree more. When I was researching the book and delving into the Holocaust and my parents' experiences and that of other Holocaust survivors and interviewing bystanders and children of bystanders, I'm a firm believer in the context of complicity, and hence the name of the book, The Crime of Complicity, that each individual has the responsibility to act. And Chuck used an interesting word, accountability. The whole idea of complicity is that you are complicit in harm caused to a vulnerable individual. For me, it's irrelevant whether you know or don't know the individual. And the idea of this gradual process whereby we turn away, we don't act, we say it's inconvenient to act, in many ways, that makes us complicit. And in the context of what you're talking about in this past hour, I really genuinely believe that each individual has the obligation to act. It's small things, you know, it's voting, it's demonstrating, it's writing letters to your congressman, to your senator. But the most important thing is to be engaged and not to turn a blind eye to harm to the innocent and vulnerable individual. That, for me, is the essence of complicity. And what's really disturbing, one, you know, use things historically and then fast forward to 2017, it is genuinely astonishing. And Kerry, you know this, we've talked to this before, that when the Daily Stormer had death threats against me, that those things are online, that's possible to have that posted online.
Right.
Complicity means that we all have the obligation to act to protect the vulnerable.
Yes.
Amy,
what would you say?
Not only do I agree that this is a time in our country's history where you must choose sides, but not in the way that Trump tried to say that. It's really, do you believe in democracy, inclusiveness? Do you believe that everyone has a right to be safe? And, what kind of country are we trying to build? And one of the things online that I've been following is on Twitter, this hashtag Goodnight Alt-Right, where a group of just independent citizens were taking photographs of those who participate in the Charlottesville protests and Nazis shouting all those things, those terrible things, and, doing that display. And one by one, without really a lot of police or federal support, or identifying making these people internet famous so that they're held responsible. And in some of those cases where you have average citizens like saying, oh, I know that person, those people have lost their jobs or have, it's really forcing people in all different sectors to say whether, how they feel about that and take responsibility, publicly responsibility. And so this group of people who are just taking this on, I think, is one example of some activism in terms of holding people accountable to the kind of actions. And there hasn't been a single arrest, by the way, in Charlottesville, even though there was a woman that was killed by the car. And when those folks in Durham, North Carolina, pulled down that statue the next day, police went to their house. The four people were arrested. But I also want to say hundreds of people showed up when those four people turned themselves in and said, well, I'm also, you can arrest me because they're not going to be bystanders or complicit in a system that allows the glorification of someone who fought a rebel war to defend slavery. So I think there's lots of ways that that people can get off the couch and start being active in terms of, a larger growing movement.
Amy Allison is one of our guests. Hang on one second, Amos, if I might. If you've just tuned into the conversation, Amy Allison is with us. She's president of Democracy in Color. And Amos Gior is with us. He's a professor of law at the University of Utah and author of a new book, The Crime of Complicity. And just to let you know what we're talking about, we're taking note of the protests and the counter-protests over this last weekend and what happened in Charlottesville. But we're also asking, what can you do as an individual who might not join a march, who wants to be engaged in this, who absolutely knows that you have to be accountable to this as well? We're giving you some practical suggestions, but we're also thinking in a larger sense of this. Is this something that you're wrestling with? I want to hear from you on that. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Kerry NPR, where Dave says, talk to those closest to you, friends, neighbors, coworkers, folks at church. Make it something people feel free to discuss openly. And Kimberly says, great question. One thought, how would you want your child to be treated? Think about it that way. Amos, you were going to say.
I was just going to jump in and say, I was interviewed here in Israel yesterday, and somebody who's familiar with my book And she asked me, what do I want people to feel when they read the book, when they think about the bystander? And my response goes to what the two of you are saying, and that is, I want them to feel the pain of the other, of the vulnerable. And when you think about the marches and so on, there's pain there. But I also want to add one more point. It's important that we not cast an overwhelmingly broad blanket over all of President Trump's supporters. We need to be really careful here. Not all of Trump's supporters were demonstrating in Charlottesville. Not all are demonstrating in Boston. I think it's really important to, if you will, to be inclusive also with respect to Trump's supporters who are not demonstrating, because I think one needs to be really careful in casting everything in a very black-white label. Mm-hmm. I think in the context of an inclusiveness and accountability, there's a danger in casting too broad of a net. History shows there's danger in that also.
Amos,
yeah, I was thinking about the American Idol, former American Idol Clay Aiken, who apologized on Twitter because he said, you know, I supported Donald Trump and I'm an idiot. I'm sorry. And the responses were, it's not too late. You can still, you know, fight for what's right in the country. So I think there's room for people who are undergoing these kind of conversions or realizing. But that the majority of people in this country are those who are put into the category of those attacked. To the extent that we can, like you were saying, be able to connect with people who are different than us and feel responsibility mm-hmm. for people who are in different groups, the more powerful the movement is that pushes out Nazism, white supremacy, and the like.
You know, Amos, one thing I'm just curious about, given that I know you talked with a lot of people from the Holocaust era, when people said, I felt helpless and I didn't think anything I could do could make a difference in what was a powerful and malevolent movement. What's the answer back to that?
The most powerful interview I had was with an 85-year-old woman whose father, in her words, was a bystander. He was a Dutch Gentile who saw the neighbors being deported from Maastricht in Holland. When she tells me the story of being 12, 14 years old and seeing this thinking about her father, she says in retrospect her father could have, should have. One needs to be careful with that because it's, you know, 75 years later. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing that I took away from my book and the 4 or 5 years I spent researching this terrible topic, it is that each and every one of us has not only the moral obligation, but for me, the legal obligation to stand and to act on behalf of the vulnerable individual. There's one thing I learned from, you know, again, my parents as Holocaust survivors and interviewing a significant number of Holocaust survivors. It's that they saw their neighbor turning their back on them. When my grandparents were deported to Auschwitz, their neighbors spat at them, threw rocks at them, and hit them, and, you know, cursed them. You need somebody to do the right thing and to act on behalf of. And when I think about what we're seeing today in the United States, it's great that people are counter-demonstrating, but there needs to be, this is I think what you're getting at, there needs to be far more action than the counter-demonstrations. There needs to be understanding that hate is a terrible thing, racism is an awful thing, and the difference, the thin line between racism and hate and violence is a really, really thin line. If there's one thing that I've taken away from working on my book, it's a really that thin line, and we need to stand and say, that's it, no more, but in a respectful way. And you cannot break the law. And I can't emphasize that strongly enough.
Amos, yeah, I really appreciate it. I just want to say thank you, Amos, very much. Really good to have you as part of the conversation. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Amos Giora's book is called The Crime of Complicity. And Amy, you were going to add.
I was just going to add that when I went to Southwest Germany, Bavaria, on a tour in 2007, I, for the first time, visited the monument to the conscientious objector. And the conscientious objector are the people in Germany that refuse to cooperate with the Nazis. And so that looks like lots of things, but I do know that there is a monument to people who exercise their individual actions and conscience, and that was a beautiful thing. We don't have anything like that in the United States, but I think this is the time where people take personal responsibility for changing not only in their life and interactions, but looking at, you know, their universities or schools or businesses and saying and demanding that every institution that they're part of take a stand and refuse to be complicit, refuse to cooperate, and become a conscious objector in their own way. And that, I think, is a healthy part of democracy and what's really needed right now.
A call here from Anthony in Eagan. Hi, Anthony. How are you thinking about this?
I've always kind of been of the thought that there's some kind of a benefit to having people being as extroverted to like these type of views as they are, mm-hmm. at least the people in Charlottesville were. Because at my own high school, I've tried to have discussions about race, and I've always found it to be a very difficult thing. And I think that when you can confront people who are so like openly public about their views, it's somewhat helpful because you can't really just ban these people from the public. Like, you have to have some kind of interaction with them and at least try to confront and change their beliefs. So I think that there is some positivity to be seen from like some things that were happening, obviously not to the extremes of killing people, but I think that it just kind of gives people that realization that that stuff is still out there and that still needs to be dealt with.
Anthony, I think this is an interesting idea. You're saying this is a catalyst for discussions and realities that we need to confront. So as painful as it is to see these nationalist and white supremacists demonstrate, it gets us to a place maybe that we're afraid to go to unless we're kind of forced there by what happened. Have I got that?
Yeah, definitely.
What do you think of that, Amy?
The challenge is if you, like I am, are part of a group who's been attacked, or if the problem is when in Charlottesville it led to injuries and death, that it's beyond just a debate. And I think for when we have a president who is signaling to white nationalists and Nazis and that what they're saying is justified and has room in the it doesn't. That hate and violence has no room in democratic society. So the challenge I have right now is giving a lot of space to these fringe hate elements has emboldened people who and actually converted, because you see a lot of these young white men who are emboldened
exactly.
By the actions. And so we have to take responsibility and say this has no place in our society. If we want to have a more of an esoteric conversation about Nazism or white supremacy, we can read about it in a book or have it in a radio conversation about it. But having it having space like that is terrifying for lots of people, millions of people across the country. It's more than just a debate about ideas. It's actual fear and danger. And that's something that we can't tolerate.
But on the other hand, I think of what you said a few minutes ago about making sure that you really, you see the people in your community. What I get the sense of is there may be more people who share this view, maybe not to the limit that these white supremacist groups do. But I sense some people wrestling with questions like, well, what's wrong with having pride around your race? Things like that they don't have enough information on to really think through. And then this kind of thing looks somewhat attractive to them. And maybe it is better that it's out there. What do you think?
I definitely think this is a time in our country, especially because it's so easy for everyone to have an opinion and spout off online
right.
and not really engage in our actually voter engagement is so low in our country. There's that's weakened the strength of our democracy. And I keep using the word democracy because it's OK to have a variety of views, but they aren't all equally protected. You cannot, when you're attacking vulnerable groups, we cannot tolerate that. And I think that having a conversation about what's right and wrong and is healthy, giving space for these groups to operate with impunity is dangerous.
Amy, always a pleasure.
So it's a fine line, yeah.
Thank you so much for making time to be with us today. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Amy Allison is president of Democracy in Color, and she hosts a podcast by the same name. If you only caught a part of this discussion, I urge you to go back and listen to it on the podcast. You can search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts. Right there as well, our conversation last week about how racism and segregation and slavery intertwine with what happened in Charlottesville, and a book conversation about the books that we cherish growing up, all there on the podcast.